Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Nexus Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just catching this broadcast, we're listening to Climate Warriors. Michael Mann, Catherine Hayhoe, and Bill Endergreg discuss their experiences as climate scientists in a field under the magnifying glass of politics, economics, and amplified emotions.
Bill Endergreg, water stress and forest is something that you study. Tell us what we can, how much of the droughts and fires that we saw in Colorado and the American West can be connected to climate today?
Certainly. Well, and this touches on your previous question as well, what is the future going to look like? And I think particularly in the Western U.S. in the last couple years especially, we've seen snapshots of what that is. That's longer fire seasons, larger fires, potentially, you know, stress on water resources, snowpack, and droughts. And so with regards to our forests that we draw a lot of economic benefits from, we're seeing really the early signs, the tip of the iceberg, as to what these forests are going to do during stress. We've seen a number of widespread, massive tree mortality events in the western U.S. and Canada in the last 5 to 10 years. These are pretty strongly linked to temperature, winter temperature, summer drought stress, and it's fairly safe to say these are kind of the early warning signals of what's coming for these ecosystems that a lot of local communities depend on.
And when you're in Colorado doing research, do people connect those dots, the causal link?
They're starting to. We do a number of public talks at community centers and high schools. And, you know, when people, you're out in the field and you're taking measurements up next to a tree or in a tree, and people always stop and they want to know what you're doing. And some of the time they want to chat and tell you what they think is happening. But if they're willing to listen to you, the vast majority of them actually do take notes and stop to think about it more.
Michael Mann?
Yeah, well, you know, 2012 here in the U.S. gave us a glimpse of the sort of future that's in store if we don't do something to avert, you know, if we don't shift away from business as usual. We saw record temperatures this last summer. We saw record drought over a large part of the country. In Colorado, that came together with record fuel, lots of dead wood, dead forests, or weakened forests because of the pine bark beetle infestation, which is happening because of record warm winters that aren't killing off these infestations. So, you know, forgive the term, it was literally a perfect storm of climate-related circumstances that came together to give us that record wildfire. What else did we see? We saw a record storm, a hybrid storm, a Hurricane Sandy, which, you know, broke previous records for flooding in New York City. And there was certainly a climate change component in the sense that of that 13-foot coastal surge along the mid-Atlantic coast, along the New Jersey coast and at New York City, at least 1 foot of that was global sea level rise. And that made a big difference. That's the difference between a bad and a disastrous flooding event. That storm was sitting over near record ocean temperatures. That means it had more moisture within it. We saw that a year ago, the previous year with Hurricane Irene, which was sitting over record warm ocean temperatures off the east coast of the U.S., meaning it had a lot more moisture in it. It was a slow-moving storm, and it dumped all of that moisture, leading to record flooding over a large part of the northeastern U.S. We saw record sea ice decline this summer in the Arctic, and scientists are starting to piece that together, potentially with the unusual trajectory that Sandy took, which was part of the coastal impact that it had.
Michael Mann is professor of geosciences at Penn State. Our other guests today at Climate One are Catherine Hayhoe, professor of atmospheric sciences at Texas Tech University, and Bill Endergreg, a doctoral student at Stanford University. I'm Greg Dalton. We talked about the pine bark beetle. I want to talk a little bit about Canada. That infestation goes all the way up. It's devastated forests in British Columbia. So, Catherine, as a Canadian, how does the U.S. debate about this differ than Canada and other countries in terms of this debate about is it real? Are we causing it?
Well, I would love to be able to say that things are very different in Canada than they are in the States, but I can't. There is definitely many more people in Canada who feel like this is an important issue, but you can have all the goodwill in the world, and if you're not doing anything about it, does it put you any further ahead? A big part of this issue, though, again, is that the solutions to climate change bring up issues that are ingrained deep in the American psyche. Words like taxation, government control, people start thinking back to 1776 when you hear words like that. So I think that there's a very different culture in Canada working together, more of a communal idea that we can work together for the greater good. So I believe that we have less obstacles to overcome than here, where independence is something that is ingrained into people's very souls.
There's also this little thing of the tar sands, though, that Canada's doing. That's,
yes.
You know, so Canada's going full bore on the tar sands as a major economic growth, which, you know, scientists would say could really blow up the whole system.
Yes, and there is significant resistance here in the U.S., but there's also very significant resistance in Canada to that work, too.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the personal attacks. I want to go back to that. There've been some. I think it was in your book, Mike Mann, that you wrote that Sir Isaac Newton, you know, if his emails had been dissected, that people could have found used that in the way that some of your emails were parsed to say you were doing some tricks that you weren't really trying to do. So,
yeah, there's a famous saying, I think it was Cardinal Richelieu, who once said, "Give me six lines by the most honest of men, and in them I will find something to hang him by." unfortunately, when you look at the jargon that we use as scientists, it's quite a bit different from, you know, the popular lexicon. You know, we use the term trick all the time to denote a clever way of solving a problem. From your earliest years in training in math and science, you learn about tricks to solving differential equations. And yet, when a public that is unfamiliar with the language of science is exposed to a quote that uses a term like trick taken out of context, and not randomly taken out of context, taken out of context specifically in a way to try to mislead them about what was actually being discussed, say, in that stolen email, it's very easy to try to convince them that scientists, that, you know, indeed, as you know, their worst fears, that scientists are conspiring to fool the public, that climate change is indeed the single greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people, which was spoken by the senior senator of what is now the hottest state ever, Oklahoma.
Well, and Mike, you just said, you know, you could take a phrase out of six lines. How many lines of emails did they have to take one phrase out of?
Exactly. So it was a cherry-picking exercise.
But I didn't really realize until I read your book that what that sentence was and what you were actually doing. So explain what you were doing, this tricky sentence that you were doing, where you were combining two different types of data.
Well, perhaps the most significant of the injustices was that it wasn't even my words and it wasn't even talking about my work, but somehow I guess I'm the one that they were really trying to go after, so it was all sort of attached to me in some way. It was an email that I received from a colleague who was talking about a clever way of comparing two different data sets, one of which ends earlier than the other. And so he had this record of temperatures based on trees, tree rings. And those trees are known not to be reliable after about 1960. They have to throw away the data after 1960. But global warming didn't stop in 1960. So he wanted to make sure that that record was placed in the context of the warming of the past few decades. And so he was comparing two different data sets. And he used a trick a plotting device, in essence, to compare those two different data sets.
Got it. Let's talk a little bit about adaptation, because there's some of this that's going to be happening anyways, no matter what we do. So what can science do to advise us, inform what we ought to do to prepare and buffer from the changes that are coming our way, no matter what we do? And Catherine, you've done some work with California, Chicago, mm-hmm. So tell us about adaptation.
Yes, I do a lot of work with regions, with cities, with states, looking at what climate change means for that location. So we've looked at California, we've looked at the city of Chicago, the Northeast. I'm doing my own work in Texas, of course, since that's where I live. And whenever we look in the future, we're always very careful to look at least two different possible futures. What will the future look like if we continue to depend on fossil fuels as our primary source of energy and temperature continues to rise? What will the future look like if we can transition in a sensible way to alternative energy and low carbon emissions? And I really like this two-pronged approach because the lower scenario shows us what we have to adapt to no matter what we do. And there is quite a bit of that. We have no magic switch to turn everything off today. So we are going to have to adapt to a certain amount of change, and we need to know what that is. If you're setting aside a refuge to protect an endangered species, and you put it where the species is today, 50 years from now, even under a lower scenario, the species could be 300 miles further north. It just doesn't make sense. We have to plan sensibly for the change that will happen. But by quantifying the higher impacts, which, for example, for California would mean loss of 90% of the Sierra Nevada snowpack. That's 45% of the water supply of California gone unless we can somehow build reservoirs to hold the rain. When we look at that scenario, looking at the differences between them helps us to quantify the benefits of transitioning from this scenario to the other. If we didn't do this analysis, the chances of being on the high scenario, I would say, would be virtually 100%. If the doctor doesn't tell you the bad things associated with eating a certain way or living a certain way, why would you ever change? The only reason we're going to change is because we learn the consequences of our poor choices. So I like to think that every time we do an assessment for a given place, looking at the difference between a business as usual future versus one where we sensibly reduce, I like to think that every time we do that, we're actually changing the likelihood of which pathway we end up going on.
So you're saying we have to go on a low carbon diet?
Yes, exactly.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
But Catherine, you say that we're not very good at our own health. We're a fat country and don't make good dietary choices when the risk is our own directly. It's in the future, but I know what I eat, right? And we don't, mm-hmm. we're not so good at even that personal, managing that personal risk if it's mm-hmm. long-term. Mike Mann?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Catherine said, we have to recognize there's a certain amount of change now that's inevitable. We've already locked it in. It's in the pipeline, and we're going to have to adapt to a certain amount of additional sea level rise, a certain amount of increased aridification in parts of the globe. At the same time, we need to mitigate those changes that we still can. The fact is, if you look at business as usual emissions, through the end of this century, we are, talking about, as James Hansen has aptly described it, we're talking about a different planet. It's not going to be the planet that we grew up on. We're talking about an environment that we cannot adapt to, that exceeds our adaptive capacity as human beings, that exceeds the adaptive capacity of ecosystems. So adaptation alone is not a viable strategy. There's some who fear that too much discussion about adaptation could lead to it being a crutch for those who don't want to take the necessary actions to reduce our carbon emissions. We have to do both. We can't use one as a crutch for not doing the other.
Is there any place to hide, any place to run to? I know people who've looked at the map and looked at little corners of British Columbia or New Zealand and say, that's where I'm going to go and get a farm. Is that folly?
There's an apocryphal story that you might have heard, too, about a Russian climate scientist back in the 1960s who had one of the first climate models back then. And in the Soviet Union in that era, he, running his calculations, concluded that there was only two nations in the world that would benefit from global warming, the Soviet Union and Canada. They didn't care about Canada, so he actually advised the government to burn all the coal they could to cause global warming because it would harm the rest of the world. They didn't take his advice, but now, 50 years later, we're well on our way to doing exactly what he recommended. And all the studies coming out of Canada and the Arctic are suggesting that those places will not benefit to nearly the extent that we thought, and the balance of the impacts will be severely negative.
So they'll have resources accessible. There'll be more drilling, natural gas, et cetera, in the northern climes from Russia and Canada. But there's also going to be, what, more floods, food stress, forests perhaps?
Fires, and melting of permafrost as well that highways and buildings can sink in as well.
So the boreal are kind of what, the lungs of the planet. Are they at risk?
Yeah, I mean, you can see in these observations of CO2 around the globe this saw-like pattern, of course, upward trending as CO2 rises in the atmosphere, but that's literally the northern hemisphere ecosystems drawing up carbon dioxide. And so it's very visible in our planet's atmosphere what the ecosystems do.
And is that diminishing as those forests come under stress, that absorption?
There's some early indications that it might be. Partially through things like drought and die-off, but also in how the soils respond to climate warming. In general, the forests provide a great, and the ecosystems, both marine and terrestrial, provide a great benefit to humans. Forests alone take up about a quarter of the emissions that humans emit every year. But there's a lot of signs, and we don't know exactly when or if we've crossed that tipping point, but there's a lot of signs that they could take up less and less and eventually become a source, and at which point they would accelerate climate warming.
So we're going to go to audience questions soon, but I just want to ask you, how do you get up in the morning dealing with all this all the time? I mean, you seriously get overwhelmed or paralyzed by this. You must have a great deal of optimism, Mike Mann, to kind of...
Yeah, if you want to call it faith, if you want to call it hope, optimism, we've risen to the occasion in the past. We've faced global environmental threats before, acid rain, ozone depletion, and we stepped up to the plate and we tackled those problems in time, maybe a little bit later than we should have, but in time to avert a true catastrophe. So I have some faith, if you want to call it that, that we will step up to the plate, even though this is a bigger problem. It gets at the roots of our global energy economy, but we will tackle this problem.
If you're just joining us, Michael Mann is professor of geosciences at Penn State. Our other guest today, Clem Owen, or Catherine Hayhoe, professor of atmospheric sciences at Texas Tech University, and Bill Andreg, a postdoc student at Stanford University. I'm Greg Dalton. We have a microphone here. I'd like to invite your participation. If you're on this side, we please invite you to go through that door. The line starts right here with our producer, Jane Ann. We invite you to join the conversation with one-part question. And if you need help keeping that brief, I'm here for you. And we'll get in as many as we can, and then we'll have a brief intermission, and we'll go on to the second part of this evening's program. So we'd like to turn out audience questions. Yes, sir, welcome to Climate One.
Thank you. My name is Peter Gisell. I work in a hospital clinical laboratory. My question has to do with the politics of dynamic modeling, especially in the social sciences rather than the environmental sciences. On the GI Bill back in 1978, I took an environmental class where I learned about the theory of global warming. And a year later, I learned about a bill in the Congress that would have challenged youth across the country to consider doing some kind of community service as an alternative to military service. I got involved with that for a year, and this article came out where I propose a youth energy corps as a part of that, more so as a counterbalance to a war in the Persian Gulf. Since then, I have not been able to get any institution, academic community, or other nonprofits to consider a dynamic model along the lines of social science towards the implications of this youth service program. So my question is, why is there so much reluctance in the academic community towards looking at a program that could help both benefit the economy, education, and the next generation?
Thank you.
Well, as an academic, I'm not sure I see reluctance to that sort of thinking. I think there's a lot of sort of outside-the-box research and discussion that's taking place in academia today when it comes to the entire coupled problem of social sort of Earth-system interactions. There's a lot of interest in understanding all of the couplings, not just the relationship between fossil fuel burning and climate change, but how humans respond to the decisions that are involved and the feedbacks that actually occur because climate is changing human behavior. Human behavior influences climate. There is a lot of research going on and looking at sort of the interesting dynamics, the social sort of Earth system coupled dynamics, if you like.
Thank you. Let's have our next question. Welcome to Climate One.
Hello, Greg, and thank you, distinguished panel. It gnaws me. My humanness comes out when I see commercials of companies that are speaking out of both sides of their mouth. This is an audience filled with letter writers and petition signers. Any suggestions on how to effectively get to these companies?
Catherine Hayhoe?
Good question. I am not speaking as an expert here. That is not my field of expertise, but I've certainly heard good results from shareholder meetings. So taking a look at your portfolio, seeing what you hold, or buying something, and then going to that meeting may be a potential way to influence a company.
That's the route, Mike Mann, that your friend Bill McKibben is going on right now.
Yeah, I mean, he's looked at the anti-apartheid movement as maybe a model for how to perhaps bring greater accountability to the fossil fuel industry and the decisions that they're making about our future. And Bill is he's a real rock star when it comes to sort of college students and energizing them and getting them involved. And after all, that's sort of what we're talking about: getting involved, influencing policymakers, influencing decision making, speaking with opinion leaders. There's a multiplier effect. We all need to sort of use whatever tools are available to us to bring this issue to the fore.
And just a reminder, that anti-apartheid chapter started in college campuses around the country. The state of California got involved. President Reagan imposed sanctions on South Africa, which led to a sequence of events that got Nelson Mandela to be president. Yes, sir, let's have... your question, welcome.
Yes, well, firstly, hi, Mike and Berlin. I'm Jim Salinger, and I'm one of these aliens from New Zealand. Well, that's how the Immigration Department here classifies me. I'm actually teaching the late Steve Snyder's course at Stanford. Enough said about me. It's very interesting when you travel around the world. It's only in US and perhaps Australia and maybe Canada that you get this denialism, which is so strong. So the first question you have to ask is why. I might suggest puritanical roots, but I'm an alien. The second thing, I was teaching the class about 3 weeks ago, and I had Right Honourable Helen Clark, who's UNDP Administrator, and we were saying, come on, you can have leadership from the top, but where is the groundswell from beneath, like in the 70s when... or 60s, when anti-Vietnam issues were important. People went out on marches. It can
Let's
be pacifist.
Hey,
sweeping. Still my guitar gently weeps. I don't know why nobody told you how to run for. Told you they bought and sold you. I look at the world and I notice it's turning.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.